Okay, why don't we go ahead and start? It looks like it's going to be a small group, but we'll go ahead and do that. Maybe some other people will come in. This is the forum on environmental issues in the Railroad Creek Valley, looking at questions of whether or not Holden is really working or taking steps towards making this in valley, as well as other having effects on the rest of the world, and keeping that sustainable. It's pretty obvious in a place like this that Holden and the activities here have an incredible impact on this particular valley, and going all the way down to the lake and further up in this whole area. And in fact, a lot of people really question as to whether or not having a place like Holden can ever really be justified in a place like this, just by its very nature and the number of people. I think Holden certainly over the years has recognized the incredible impact that this village has, and has tried over the years to be as environmentally responsible as possible. And I think that the challenge is still there to always keep looking at that and considering how we can improve the things we're already doing, and perhaps have to start some new kinds of ecology that we haven't even ever done before. With that in mind, what we wanted to do tonight was look at five particular things that Holden is either doing now or really concerned about. Not that these are the only five at all that we are either doing anything about or should be doing something about. But there are five that we've chosen for one of two reasons. One, because we think there will be a particular interest to people, and two, because we hope that at least most of them will have some kind of practical transfer value. In other words, that what we're doing here can perhaps be something that people can learn from and take back home. The tailings will not be one of those. I doubt if too many people have copper tailings in their backyards, but the rest of them are things that we think that that the what's being done here at Holden over the years and developed as common practice is something that you really can consider back in your own homes. So what we're going to do is to we've had five people here on the staff who are going to speak on particular each of those five particular issues for about 5 minutes each. And so we're really just going to briefly address the problems and what we're doing, and just sort of to raise the issues, and then really open it up for the whole last half of the forum for questions and discussions. We hope that, again, the questions and discussions will help people here to assimilate some of the knowledge that's here, as well as challenge those of us who live at Holden to be more responsible and even better stewards of the gifts that we've been given than perhaps we are now. So we're just going to go in this order. I, as of 10 minutes ago, am doing the last one, so it's going to be very much off the cuff, but won't be too hard. So why don't we start with Margaret?
Okay. This is a little bit off the cuff too, because I am not the garbologist here. Our garbologist is on and out. But I said, well, I would read up on garbology. I think it's fairly interesting, and I can just tell you a little bit about what I know. I think we're all familiar with it because we all play a vital part in it every time we bring our dishes to the garbage, and when we stack them and bring them to the kitchen. And I think most of you are familiar with the two divisions of compostable and combustible. And you don't get those mixed up. You know, if you throw your napkins in there, compostable, you got to dig it out, put it in the combustible. But that's pretty important because separating all the garbage helps to get it taken care of quicker, more efficiently. And there's a lot of garbage that has to be taken care of. I think because Holden is so isolated, that was something that was made very aware in the beginning. After a while, there's just no more place to dump things. And so the garbage is set up to be recycled as much as possible. The combustible can be burned, and when they collect so much, then it's burned in incinerators. There's a careful process with that. The things that are burned are like the paper products and the chicken bones, and also sometimes oil rags that are used in the print shop. The combustible, or compostable, then, is used in composting piles, and those are done up on upper levels. Bins are set up, and they're scientifically, I can't explain the whole scientific process, but with layers, they use tailings and some ashes from the combustible, and with tailings, and then with layers of garbage, and then dirt again, and so forth. And then the temperature, they check the temperature once it starts, and they have bins, I think six of them, and the temperature rises for a couple days, and then it falls, and the composting process is taking place then. When that is completed, that's emptied out, and there's a pile of that, and that dirt then is used, or compost, I guess to be a more accurate term, is used around the village where they planted grass, I think, where they added the grass by the hike house, and that was with compost. So that takes care of those two areas, but then there is the problem of aluminum and glass and plastics. Those are separated too, and the aluminum can be recycled, and Tom will tell you a little bit more about that. The plastics and glass are buried then up in the tailings in a landfill, and it does look like a dump up there, and they can put so much in, and then they have to cover it and to keep the prevent the bears from coming up and tearing things up, and then they dig another hole again later and bury that, so like landfills that you're probably familiar with in your own areas. So that's some of the garbology that takes place at Holden. It's real basic. And if you have any questions, I don't know if I can answer them, but you know, later on if you have some, maybe others here too can help out.
Yeah. All right, Tom? Today was, as I understand it, the first recycling that's been done in the village, although we have the solid waste management plan, which was written up in 1983 by Werner Jansen. And in it says, reading in their section on recycling, "Recycling is an excellent method for reducing the amount of solid waste which requires disposal by landfill. Currently, all aluminum steel cans are recycled. Glass is still disposed of in the landfill, but this too will probably be recycled in the near future. All recyclable materials are stored in the village and then hauled out for disposal twice a year." So according to this, in 1983, they were recycling. However, we have never found any records indicating that this has happened or whatever. So I can't say for sure whether it did or didn't. Here it says they were doing it, but we've never found anything to indicate that. Recently, well, since Bob Gracious came, he has done a lot to try and encourage the recycling. He's written all the letters to different people. Finally, we made contact with like Tacoma Recycling, and they gave us a couple prices, like on aluminum cans, they would pay us 23 cents a pound if we delivered at their door in Tacoma, which obviously we don't have the vehicles on the other end. We did finally go with the Tillion. It's a family out of Wenatchee that recycles. They sent us a price list of several things that they would accept. And then we have been up in the level 3. Over years, they have recycled, or haven't recycled, they separated the aluminum cans, aluminum foil, and a few other things to a certain degree. And then today, the carpenters last week built 5 bins for us, which will be used as many times as possible, whenever we have enough material to justify shipping it out, or rather, enough material for Detillion
to justify coming up to Chelan to pick it up. Our current, the price that the barge charges us is 3 cents a pound. And that, of course, includes a container that we send it out in and then getting the containers back. I'm guessing, I don't know if anyone else who handled it could make a better guess, I'd say maybe the container's 200 pounds. I'm not sure on that, our plywood bins that we're sending out. So that would cost us $6 each way or $12 per round trip to send the bins out and back, which of course will cut down on our profit margin. Everything else is, well, everything else as well will cost us 3 cents on the barge. To give you an example, aluminum, they will pay 15 cents a pound for, and they pick it up at the barge. Also, brass, 17 cents a pound. Some types of copper, 20 cents a pound. The policy is any money, if we do actually make a profit on anything, that stays in a recycling budget. So it will not be spent somewhere else in the village or on another program. So we sent some of our best, our most profitable things on this barge trip that will go out this week. And then that money will stay in a recycling budget to help pay for other things. An example is scrap iron cost. They will pay a penny a pound in Chelan. It cost us 3 cents to just ship it on the barge. So we realize that we're losing money. We're losing 2 cents for every pound we send out. But if we can make the money on some other areas, we will gladly spend that 2 cents a pound to help get rid of some of the other products. On the other end, we have 64, 65 of these World Watch papers, which are up in the Portal Museum. And many of them are related to ecology or issues of this sort. I'll give you a couple examples of what it does. Here it says the energy required to recycle aluminum is only 4% of that required to produce it from bauxite, the original raw material. So only 4% of the energy. Some other examples, copper. You can recycle copper at 1/10 of the energy to produce copper originally. Steel, produced entirely from scrap, saves 47%. Recycling newspaper saves 23% of the energy, but we also have to remember it cuts pressure on the forest. 1 ton of recycled newsprint saves a ton of wood. So there's other things involved besides just purely cost. Recycling glass containers saves 8% of the energy. So they are not, we haven't found anyone to take glass because that's not a very profitable thing. But yet it cuts down on raw materials we have to dig up. Steve made a good comment the other day when we were up on top, saying that all the copper we send out saves on more tailing piles like this being made.
Okay. The biggest garbage pile at Holden Village is that of the tailings. There's 80 acres of tailings, and those tailing piles can be as deep as 80 feet. The estimated weight of those tailing piles is 9 million tons. Now, when the Howe Sound Mining Company donated Holden Village to the Lutheran Church, they also gave them the mineral rights. Now, at the time they donated the village and the mineral rights, they told the Lutheran Church that there was an estimated $1 million worth of gold in the tailing piles. However, that figure was based at $35 an ounce. Presently, the cost of gold is about $350 to $400 an ounce. So essentially, at least $10 to $11 million worth of gold. If the price of gold continues to rise, say to the level it was in 1980 of between $800 and $900 an ounce, one serious option that the village is considering is hiring somebody to truck the tailings out. Now, if they choose to take that course of action, they're going to have to decide on several things. first and foremost that's going to be affected is the atmosphere of the village. You're going to have large dump trucks moving that out on a fairly regular basis of at least 8 hours a day. A second, because part of the tailings, as I understand it, is located on Forest Service property, the Forest Service is undoubtedly going to ask for a cut of the pie, so to speak. Now, there is, with the metals market, a general fluctuation in the price of gold and silver. Now, if they choose to do that, that's something they're going to have to consider, is whether they want to invest the money to start this project when the price of the metals could go down. That's one serious problem they have. In terms of the composition of the tailing piles, there are a number of chemicals present in the tailings. There's copper sulfate, hydrated lime, pine oil, Barrett number 4 oil, and sodium cyanide, the most serious of which is sodium cyanide. Now, some of that is still in the tailing piles, and some of it has been dispersed through the years down into Railroad Creek. But removing that is a concern for the ecology of the forest. In a report from the Department of Ecology, dated February 12, 1986, they looked at it, and at this point they assessed that there was, quote, no evidence that has been found to suspect an environmental problem that exists to warrant a site that is a minute inspection. And then potential environmental problems have been adequately identified and are being resolved. So there is no immediate problem with the tailings, although one could develop over time. With the oxidation of the iron in it and with other chemicals that are in the tailings, which I'm not that familiar with, there could develop a problem with the acid. However, the acid will be dispersed over a long period of time. Right now, the oxidation covers about 1/2 inch per each year, and at 80 feet, that's going to take several centuries to fully complete, but it's something that does have to be kept in mind.
Thanks. We purposely separated garbage from food on the agenda, so.
Food is obviously not as obvious an issue as garbage at Holden, but it's, I think, an important way issue in terms of the way that we use our resources. Much of the kitchen philosophy here at Holden was developed about 10 or 12 years ago when there was a shift from kind of a typical American meat and potatoes diet to the kind of eating that you might see here today, which is lots of whole grains and lots of fruits and vegetables in place of some of the heavier meat meals. This summer, some of the cooks dug up some of the old menus from the early 1970s and found that they had meat almost 3 times a day. You know, a breakfast sausage, then some kind of a noon meat, then dinner. They had dessert every day, and usually some kind of a Jell-O salad with whipped cream, whatever. Their bread was shipped in, it wasn't baked here, and they had Kool-Aid on every table at lunch and dinner, in addition to a pitcher of water. So, obviously there have been some changes. Holden currently, if I get the figures right, Holden currently feeds people at about $2 per day. Each person is fed about $2 per day. I think in the development of that philosophy, there were, I think, two basic issues that guided some of those folks and perhaps also those today who are making decisions about how to use food. I think the first concern was health concerned. I think the other concern was world resources, which is more vague, but I think tied into the way that we try to use our food. In terms of health, even government figures, U.S. government figures, show that Americans get about twice as much protein as they need every day. And there are many people who feel that the grain that is used to produce, let's say, a pound of meat could be better used to feed people instead of animals. Another issue is sugar. Americans still consume about 100 pounds of sugar each year,
And of course, there are strong links between sugar and problems with obesity, diabetes, tooth decay, hyperactivity in kids, etc. Another issue that we are conscious of here is salt, a basic staple of diets in the United States, also a major contributor to problems with high blood pressure. Also processed foods, many of them contain additives and preservatives and are less nutritious than a lot of raw foods. In terms of world resources, many believe that as Americans we are used to so much, and it's important in our lifestyles to be sensitive and aware of the way that we as a minority use the majority of the world's resources, and that we can respond to this by using what we have in wiser ways. In terms of some of the concrete ways that we do things at Holden, most of our meals are not centered on meat. We try different whole grain foods like the tofu stir fry that you had tonight, or the millet fiesta that you had this noon. Breads and salads play a big part in the meals that we have here, and we try to be creative with different kinds of food and not just those that many of us were raised on. We use a lot of whole foods. We go through about 700 pounds a week of whole wheat flour, and you'll find that in the bread and the egg kaka and the pancakes that you have. We use this in addition to, not instead of, white flour, which has fewer vitamins and minerals. We go through, what if we figure, about 500 pounds a week of white flour, so we haven't gotten rid of that. You also find a lot of use of brown rice instead of white rice, because we think it's more nutritious. A lot of use of millet, barley, bulgur, raw fruits and vegetables whenever we can get them, instead of those that are packaged and processed and lots of sugar. We also make most of our foods from scratch. Breads, pastries, soups, sauces. We make our own mayonnaise, granola, muesli, yogurt, sprouts, salad dressing, croutons, etc. That helps us avoid the need for additives and preservatives, and I think, I don't know, might be a little more fun. Also, we try to be conscious about our use of leftovers. It's estimated that the United States throws enough food away each year to feed all of Canada. I just read that recently. One meal, or one lunch each week at Holden, is made up of leftovers, featuring a review of the week's surprise casserole. You also find leftovers in soups and breads in ways that you might find surprising. In breads, we use potato waters and egg whites. Leftover hot cereals and leftover egg kaka and stir-fried vegetables, usually anything that we can find in the walk-in that we think could be easily disguised and put in bread. We also do that in soups too. When we're cutting up vegetables for salads, we save the carrot tops and scraps from green peppers, celery, etc., and boil those trimmings together for broth, which is then used in soups and gravies and breads. And we also save the cooking water most of the time when we cook broccoli or potatoes, and because of the nutrients in that water. Also, if we have a roast beef meal or a pork meal, we will save those trimmings and boil those, or chicken stock, and make broth out of those for a soup that we might have on a later day. In the wintertime at Holden, in the past at least, we have one evening meal a week is designated as a hunger awareness meal, which will be maybe a simple meal of rice or let's say baked potatoes, and the money that is saved from that meal is given to a project or some concern that's been designated by the community, so that we can maybe be contributing some of our financial resources and also in some ways being more aware perhaps of how much we have. I think sometimes the kitchen is accused of being too serious about food, but I think that we have a lot of fun with it. We have endless discussions about egg kaka. And we have a lot of fun with our Sunday feasts, whether it's a brunch outside on the summer day or a more fancy meal in the winter. We think food is something to be celebrated and used responsibly.
One of the major environmental issues at Holden is the number of people who are here. If you, in the summer, have over, say, 400, 450 people concentrated in this one particular place, then one of the obvious environmental concerns is simply the number of people by times two gives you the number of feet that walk around this area. And obviously a lot of people, or most people, come to Holden because of the setting and because they also not only want to sit in this room and listen to programs, but because they want to go hiking or climbing and perhaps for some overnight camping. And a lot of people don't realize, especially if they've come from areas of the country where they haven't spent that much time outdoors, how much impact there is simply by people walking around. And so one of the real serious environmental responsibilities that a place like Holden has is to educate people and to, in some ways, try to enforce some adherence to rules about having as minimal impact as possible on the environment around here. There are not too many places in a national forest or a national park nearby where you have this number of people who are concentrated into one area. So it's even that much more important. And I think a number of people at Holden feel like we really, and I'm fairly new here, but quite new, that has been one area that probably we need to do a lot more with. That there has not been as regular and an intentional effort here to have programs that really do help inform people who are here about the kinds of things that they need to be aware of and concerned about and very attentive to when they're walking around, even if it's just to take an hour stroll down the road and up to the falls. The days of the sort of classic Boy Scout camping techniques are over. I know when I was a Boy Scout, you know, the Boy Scout manual was full of all these things where you chop down trees and build shelters by lashing the logs together and all this kind of thing, and you always built a fire. And that was all fine and well, perhaps in areas where there were hardly any people who ever came in, and so the impact was relatively minimal because only a few people ever did that. But the more and more that our resources, our wilderness areas, our national forests are used by people who go in just for backpacking or camping, the more that people have to be aware of the fact that in some areas you really should not build a fire at all. And people just are horrified at the idea of going out for a camping experience and not be able to sit around a campfire at night and singing songs or whatever. But that kind of thing, things like simply staying on trails. I know I'm always fond of the statistic that I don't see too much of it around here, but from in New Hampshire, where I've done quite a bit of climbing, there are map lichens on a lot of the rocks, and supposedly if you step on a map lichen, it will immediately kill it, and it usually takes about 50 years for it to regrow. So simply somebody getting off the trail and walking around in places like that or other plants, you can immediately, especially with big heavy boots, kill the plants. Similarly, crossing switchbacks, where instead of going all the way around them, but everybody likes to take a shortcut right through. And you can obviously see around here where there are a lot of places that people have been doing that. And again, it just destroys whatever plants are in there. It also causes erosion where it washes out. Things like camping in particular areas. In some places, the Forest Service wants you to camp in the same place that other people have camped so that you only damage a particularly limited area. In other places, the policy is just the opposite, so that people don't ever camp in the same area so that you don't ever wear out one particular spot. And people need to be aware of those things, of not camping more than or in less than 150 to 200 feet from water. Again, because of pollution and also because there's a tendency to everybody want to camp right next to the water, so therefore it'll wear out a particular area. So there's a whole list of things, and some of that we do have here in the hike house and try to give people that information. And it's the kind of thing that having a program here which draws in as many people as we do, we really do have to take very seriously. And there's a lot more than what I've just mentioned that we need to get across to people, both for those of us who live here all for an extended period of time, as well as people who come in only for a few days. Okay, that concludes as far as the formal presentations. I've also asked David Garter to come in for the part of discussions and questions. Some of you may have been in here at 6:30 for a presentation he did on sort of looking at the whole history of the Forest Service and Holden's history with the Forest Service, and especially looking at the recent sort of process, the ongoing process that the Forest Service is going through right now for looking at possible the land use plan for this particular national forest and how that could impact Holden Village. So any of you who are there for that and want to ask more questions about that or any of the rest of them, David's here to do that. So why don't we throw it open for any questions, discussions, comments that anybody has, and go from there. We have a good 25 minutes to go. So anything?
I have a question for the garbologist representative. When you said that they'll use landfills, how long does a hole in the ground last before it's covered up? I mean, we're talking 6 months, a year, 2 weeks?
Anyone know? I don't think it's very long. I think it's like maybe a couple of weeks or something.
You mean?
And they put more dirt over it.
I think we're trying to do it weekly.
Oh, weekly? Okay.
Well, I didn't know if you were talking like the size of an outhouse or the size of a city or something.
Isn't a big hole dug like for the summer and then they gradually keep filling it in? That's kind of
weird. Yeah, to a certain degree. They have one time on the first tailings here where it's dug out, they started putting those tailings back into the mine at one time and tried doing it that way. So we have a big area that's much lower in the center than the surrounding. Mm-hmm. So they just keep piling up in there.
What happened to that?
I don't know.
Questions? Larry?
I have a question about the tailings. I saw they were trying to grow some trees up there. Are there other options other than just hauling it out that they're being explored?
Well, they've tried various things. They've tried planting a few trees experimentally. They tried planting Jerusalem artichokes on tailings too, the second tailings pile. And they pump sewer effluent up there to really give it a strong start. And while they were pumping the sewer effluent up there, the artichokes were doing quite well, but the process of doing that, of pumping up the sewer effluent, was too expensive, so they had to stop it. And the artichokes have been more or less holding their own, but it's been a downhill battle for them. Each year they get a little less green and a bit more brown, and that's because of the high acidity of the tailings pile. On the pH scale, it's about 3 or 4. It would be the equivalent of trying to grow something in pickle juice. So it's very difficult, but they are exploring different ways.
You grow pickles?
No, I don't think so.
It sounds like you're not really planning on getting the mineral out of those tailings. It wouldn't be feasible.
Well, there
sounds like a lot of stuff in there yet.
Right, there is. One of the reasons they quit extracting gold was because of the high quantities of cyanide they were using. The Forest Service was coming down very hard on the House Island Mining Company because of that. And as a result, the gold was pumped out with pulverized rock at the end of the flotation process, which separated the precious metals, that is the gold, the copper, the zinc, and the silver, from the useless rock, essentially the garbage rock. And as I mentioned, if the price of gold continues to climb to a point where they can make a profit at removing it, that's something they will do. But the metals market is very unpredictable.
Who's the they? You mean Holden? Or
yes, the decision would be made by the Holden Village Board.
You might just mention that all that stuff is being analyzed now, isn't it?
Beg your pardon?
Isn't all that being analyzed?
Yes, there's a company based in Tacoma that is assessing the situation right now, and at this point I don't know what their results are, but it is something that is under consideration.
It's money in the bank, man, that they might find something that instead of poking it in back in the mine or getting rid of it, it surely be, if they could find a way.
Mm-hmm.
That's still a lot of money to me.
Right. And you're right, it is.
A lot of money to get it out, like Tom was saying, it's going to cost, you know, almost as much to get it out.
Find a way, you know.
Yeah.
They don't give up on something like that.
Oh, no, they aren't.
There are frequently people come up to analyze the tailings and,
yeah,
you call them prospectors for this company.
If I could make a comment about that, I think, there's a certain loss of sight of what our goal should be, or maybe a lack of clarity. Is it to remove the tailings? Is it to make money on precious metals that may be there? Assuming that gold prices return to where they were previously is incredibly dangerous, as you suggest, Tom. Mm-hmm. The precious metals market is very depressed and shows no sign of increasing. So perhaps more appropriate issue is how do we get rid of them, not how we make money off of them. And if there's some way to do that by making some money off of them, then we'll find that. That seems to be a problem that the village has beat its head against every 5 years or 10 years when a new group of people comes along. It's my understanding. I'm not certain we're going to be able to solve it either.
But it's going to cost money one way or the other if you make money out of there. Not by just if you make money out of it, why not?
I don't know that much about it, but I'm not sure that the issue is ever making money off of it. It's a matter of how much money you can get out of it to pay for most of the transporting. I mean, it's going to cost more than $10 million probably to get it all out. It's a matter of whether or not you can pay for most of it.
As Tom suggests, that's really begging the issue of what is that going to do to Railroad Creek Valley and the whole mission of Holden, where we've got the trucks running up and down our beat on road right now, you know, with the remnants of the tailings. So.
Yeah.
Right.
Tom?
Yeah.
I think that one plan for the juice from artichokes was to use it for fuel. Do you know what that thing
gas.
Did it work?
Nothing gas. Right. They were hoping to
But nothing came
up. No, when they had to quit pumping the sewer effluent up there, and it became evident that the Jerusalem artichokes would not be able to really develop without that. That problem, or that possibility, really fell through.
Was that really an economic problem, Tom, or was it the Forest Service kind of clamped down on us pumping effluent up on the tailings?
To the best of my knowledge, it was an economic problem. Yeah.
It was economic.
Mm-hmm.
For fossil fuel.
Right.
They use fossil fuel, so they try to get methane that takes the place of fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm. Another, sure.
Yeah.
Nobody addressed human waste. Is that a problem here, or is that dealt with as far as, it seems like with the large amount of people that you're having, some of that might eventually be a problem too?
Yes, and there's been a lot of money spent on that in the last, about $250,000. Does anybody, it was a matter of choosing five particular things, and that one was left out because primarily, to be very honest, those people who know the most about it are not here right now. So that's, but whoever knows something about it.
We were pumping up into the lower area in the first tailings pile, and then they did the sewer project last fall. And we now have two drainage fields up in the old miners' village underground drainage, and that is not working as well or like they had hoped. So now it's, I think, going to be going back into a tailings on a different project, but I don't know the status either on it. In this book on their solid waste management plan, they said that they get around, I think it was 9,000 pounds every 2 years. But when they said they take it up to put it on the, they have to pump that out or haul it out, they take it up on a tailings, and every 2 years they get enough to make a 9-inch deep area for drying. I think it's 10 feet by 40 feet. So it's not a tremendously large area on that to dry down to a certain, to 60% moisture, and then they use it for other things that can be used, like in with the compost or in with soil.
Doesn't that have to go through a treatment plant?
Well, in a way it already has, because that's taking it out of the septic tank.
I just think to remember about that is we're not putting lots of other stuff in the sewer. Like you have, you know, industrial stuff and things like that, so you have to go through quite all the processes that you do back in the big cities.
Yes, Mary.
I'm curious, I guess, as to the decision-making process. It sounds like, you know, I haven't been up here very long either, but my impression is such that, you know, it sounds like a lot of different projects have been started and haven't turned out as, you know, idealistically as people had hoped. But what sort of decision-making process? You mentioned, you know, the board, but, I mean, you know, your average board member probably doesn't have, you know, do you bid on things like for the tailings, you know, to have the tailings analyzed or sewer system? I mean, how does all that decision-making process go? Who says this idea might work, and then 2 years later, does it work? You know, who draws the line? I guess I'm asking.
You're probably not talking to the right people. I don't know if anybody. I mean, it is a board ultimately. The board.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, do they say like, you know, do they have something in the Constitution or whatever you call it up here that says, you know, 5 bids must be made by 5 separate contractors or? Or anything like that, or is it just an idea, or is it just rather, hey, let's try this? You know, I guess that's my question, because it sounds like a lot of things are started in, like, the sewer system.
I don't know if anybody can speak to the processes and boards. I don't think it's just like, hey, let's, I know that
yeah,
in some of the things like the sewage and the tailings, I mean, obviously a lot of very, very detailed analysis going into it, but I know that, for instance, what little I know about the sewage problem was that evidently there was there's great difficulty geologically analyzing the soil here, and that the original analysis indicated one thing, and now that they've gotten, when I got to a certain depth or something, that was something different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the part of the problem of why the original, what was originally done now has to be modified with, unfortunately, a fair amount of expense. But I don't know whether that was something that could have been avoided or not. I really have no idea. And I don't know if anybody else has any idea around here, please.
I think the Forest Service plays a large part too, oftentimes, doesn't it? Like, a lot of decisions can't be made because the Forest Service has plans.
I think it's accurate to say that they contract a lot. I mean, the board is aware of all these problems. They've been aware, problems have been around for a long time. They do, a lot of people on the board who have various resources, and the board decides as a group who to contract out to. But then also the business manager sits on the board, and for example, with the sewer system, business manager did a lot of the work with that, and, you know, any major expenditure of money, the board has to approve of, but the board always relies on the expertise of the people with Holden, the director and the business manager who sit on the board.
Well, that sewer contractor I know has been fired.
He'll be back next week.
Situation. No, there was an engineer, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah, the engineer.
I don't know the details on that.
Actually, I believe the village is suing, screwing up the sort of task or something.
Any other questions, comments?
Tom, do you know how serious the cyanide problem with the tailings is? How dangerous is all that stuff, really?
Well, with cyanide, they began the mining originally in April of 1938, and by 1947, the Forest Service realized that the aquatic life in Railroad Creek was being affected, and they put pressure upon the Howe Sound Mining Company to find an alternative. What they decided, that is the Howe Sound engineers, was that they pumped the tailing piles back into the mined out chambers called stopes, and they began doing that, and from 1947 to 1951 that was carried out. However, the stopes, the way they were dug, were not designed to hold the weight from the tailings, and the stope sprung a leak. The tailings dribbled down to the lower levels where the mining was still in progress. Miners came to work the next week and they found they were knee deep in the tailings muck. Cost $250,000 and 1 year's worth of work to clean that out. So in getting back to the cyanide, they started pumping it back out onto the tailing piles again. To the best of my knowledge, most of the cyanide is in the tailing piles, but there is a certain rate of dispersal into Railroad Creek, because the tailing piles are built upon retaining ponds, and I don't mean ponds in the sense of water, but they're large holes, sloping holes, into which the tailings were put. So I would say the rate of dispersal for the cyanide is minimal, but it's definitely still there. Does that answer your question?
I have a related one. Yeah. Like when that dust is blowing and blowing and blowing and you breathe it, is it so minute that it doesn't matter that you're breathing cyanide or it's in your eyes?
I don't have any information on that. The best I can tell you is that 85% of the tailings are what's called, and I'm reading here, practically insoluble silicate minerals. Now, silica is extremely small glass shards. I think the rate at which you breathe them here, unless it's an incredible windy period for an extended period of time, is not health threatening. Now, for those who have severe respiratory problems, it might be wise for them to carry surgical masks. But again, I'll point out this is speculation on my part. I've seen no evidence indicating that the tailings, when the wind kicks up, that are blown, constitute a serious health hazard.
What about gases? Are there any kind of gases that are released from all those chemicals in there? Anyone knows about?
Not that I'm aware of, although there could be.
Any questions? Comments? Yes, Jim.
Well, getting off the tailings, Margaret, I missed your talk, so you may have mentioned this. I just got a really dumb question. What are we using the compost for? Is it being used in Ann's pots and in the garden?
Yeah.
And
use it in flower beds when
because I know that there was a bunch that was spread out on the tailings by the garbage dump. And I didn't know whether we were just kind of backfilling it into the tailings or whether we were actually using it.
In fact, I think that malaria that was added on by the high cost over there, I think the dirt was compost.
The combination.
Because
I don't think it was pure compost.
Okay, it was a combination.
Mixed with topsoil.
Does anyone know if it's been working real well? I mean, it's obvious these flowers are evidence of that.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it seems to. Plus the places that they seeded grass this year as a compost mixture and other things.
Yeah, Steve.
Ask one thing. It may or may not pertain to this particular area, but I guess David's wanting to address this to the Forest Service land use plan. In different parts of the country, it comes up different forestry departments. And you hear about the forestry department comes up and says what the general public is doing to destroy the land. But according to some research that I've done, that the Forest Department, of course, the federal government, which is authorized in certain sections for loggers to take land on or trees off the ground. Of course, they're getting away from, and they have for several years, keeping the trees and not floating them down the rivers because of the pollution that's done to the water. But also, they're having a problem, what I understand now, the fuel to use in their chainsaws and the gasoline, the oil and things, even though they're utilizing a specific distance away from the water, this is penetrating down through the earth and coming in and polluting the water. If you know what I'm saying?
In general, yeah.
By rains coming in and washing all this stuff down to the water. So, and I'm not trying to put blame on anybody else except the fact that it seems like the Forest Service ought to be a little bit more, you know, concerned about how this is damaging the water and natural resources, along with, you know, what the average person is doing. Do you have any comment on that?
The Forest Service bears a pretty big responsibility in terms of their timber sales. And it's something on which they're probably criticized more often than anything else. They have allowed, and under federal mandate, have to sell a certain amount of timber. And it's from those timber sales that the Forest Service gets most of its money to operate, because that's the main source of revenue for the Forest Service, that and the grazing rights that it gets for allowing cattlemen and sheep herders and others leases on federal Forest Service land to graze their animals. So the Forest Service really can't refuse to sell timber to various companies, which is unfortunate. The harvesting of timber that's done by the companies is damaging, especially in two or three ways. One, as you mentioned, the oil and so forth from these operations gets into the soil and leaches down into the groundwater, which runs into the streams. And that sort of oil in the soil is not at all conducive to most vegetation. But probably even more damaging is, especially in the western mountains, where salmon and other fish come up stream to spawn, the clear cutting and other kinds of forestry practices allow a good deal of sawdust and waste wood to come down into the streams, and that smothers the natural sandbars and gravel beds in which the salmon and other fish can spawn. And as a result of that, it really destroys more habitat for fish than is really intended by the Forest Service or really expected. And that's something in which they're starting to catch a good deal of flack now, and probably will even more so in the future. Another thing where the Forest Service has been criticized with this whole business of timber sales is allowing the companies to replant trees. And at first glance, that doesn't seem like a very bad practice, because here the companies are coming in, taking the timber, and then they're replanting the forest. And so that sounds really great. You know, here they're reforesting this area that they've eliminated from forest. But what's wrong with it is that usually the companies will replant one type of tree at one age. It's called monotype replanting, or monotyping. And when you plant all one kind of tree at one age, you make the land produce very heavily from a very narrow base of minerals, a very narrow base of soil, fertilizer, and so all of the minerals of the same kind are sucked out of the soil into this mass of trees. With the trees all being of the same type and of the same age, and if these clear cuts and reforesting of monotype trees cover large areas, they're also subject to the same kinds of disease and insects and other kinds of hazards that affect trees in the national forest. And where that happens, once you get an infestation of a disease or an insect or something going, it can easily take off and destroy the whole area that's been monotyped. And because of that, it can spread over into nearby areas, because with that large base of land that is conducive to those pests, then it's easier for those pests to breed in very large numbers and get over into other stands of trees that are of different ages or even different types. So there are a number of problems with that whole issue of monotyping. Also, monotype tree replanting is very bad for wildlife, because the typical deer that you see around Holden Village, or the bears, or the other kinds of wildlife, the owls or the hawks or whatever, prefer in general to have a diversity of vegetation. And if they can have some brush and some trees and some meadow, that's the best for most of the, especially for most of the large mammals, which are the things that people usually associate most with the forest. And one type of tree all at one age is particularly poor habitat for most kinds of wildlife. So there are some very specific and useful purposes for monotyping, but it's usually on a very small scale and in very small and selected areas. And when the timber sales are made, they're frequently made with this provision for reforesting that allows for monotype replanting. And of course, when the company is monotype and replant, they also almost ensure that the Forest Service is going to have to come back to them again in 20 or 30 or 40 years when that tree farm is back to harvestable age and sell the same trees to them again. So it locks in this cycle of timber sales on that particular plot of land over a period of, in some cases, several generations. So there are a number of areas where they have to be very careful, and that's where they're catching a lot of criticism right now.
Okay, let me ask one more thing. You're talking about the criticism tonight that the Forest Service is receiving. I'd hardly take any action about this.
I'm just going to have to say we're essentially out of time, so be aware of that.
They're not. I don't think they're taking adequate action on that.
I didn't mean to cut you off that much.
Well, they're taking some action, but they're not taking enough. Yeah. They're not taking those criticisms to heart, and they're not actually implementing that kind of plan for the forest. Occasionally, they'll try to cut a particular company a little bit short on the amount of timber that they sell or something, but they haven't really put the clamps down on that kind of practice in general, which is unfortunate, I think. Because you still find it. In fact, in this Wenatchee National Forest that we've been talking about earlier today, there are a number of timber sales that are proposed under their new plan, which would go forward with this kind of clear-cutting action and the reforesting of monotype trees and so forth. And that can be very dangerous, I think, for this forest. And for those of you who were here earlier, for anybody who's interested, if you want to participate in the Wenatchee National Forest planning process, you can write to Donald Lyons, whose address is over here on the board. And if you want to mention some of Holden's concerns, you may. Or if you want a sample letter, I've got copies of a sample letter here that you can have if you'd like to. They're also available around the village as well. So. If you're interested in responding to the Wenatchee National Forest, feel free to do so. I've got some sample letters here.
We'll take one quick question from Carrie, and then this will be the last question.
Make comments like the Forest Service doesn't like us being here, and if we make any false moves, who knows, they could shut us down. Is that accurate at all?
Well, no. Most of the people that we know who have anything to do with the Wenatchee National Forest, the rangers, the superintendent, the other people who are actually working with the Wenatchee National Forest, realize that Poland Village has cooperated extensively with the National Forest in the past. They basically like what we're doing. They think that we're doing a quality job in what we're doing, so that there's no substantive problem between the National Forest Service and Poland Village at this time. However, Holden Village is not known very well outside of the Wenatchee National Forest professionals, so that other people in the National Forest Division don't know much about Holden Village or how it's operated in the past. And as a result, they can sometimes make decisions arbitrarily without really considering the interests of Holden Village or the relationship that Holden Village has built up over the past with the National Forest Service. One example of that is the buildings at Lucerne. Some of you may have been here in past years when the buildings still existed at Lucerne. And for those of you who were here, you know that Lucerne used to have a tavern and some cabins and some other buildings down there at one time. And that was also at one time the buildings went to Holden Village as well. But the Forest Service, the Wenatchee National Forest people, wanted a plan that was proposed by Holden Village several years ago to improve that development at Lucerne and provide some modern facilities for allowing people to transfer from the boat up to the road. And there would have been a reception center and some other buildings down there. And that was a fairly well-developed plan. But it was approved by the Wenatchee National Forest people in Wenatchee, but when it got to the regional level in Portland, they turned it down. And when they turned it down, they said that Holden also had to tear down all the buildings at Lucerne at the same time, so that there are no buildings down at Lucerne anymore, and that's the reason. So sometimes after things get out of the Wenatchee National Forest and get to another level, there isn't the same kind of developed relationship with Holden Village that the people in the Wenatchee National Forest actually have.
But they do have the power to shut us down pretty fast.
Oh, yeah. We're here, the land we're sitting on now is National Forest Service land. Holden Village is using it on a special use permit. 3 years of that special use permit have gone by. We've got 17 years to go on this special use permit. The longest period for which you can get a special use permit is 20 years. And Holden Village has one of those special use permits right now. And so if the Forest Service wanted to cancel that special use permit, if they did it properly, they could eventually do it. But it would take more than a little effort on their part to do that. They couldn't do it arbitrarily. But everything around here, the roads into the village, the whole forest around here, all the services that come in and go out of Holden Village,